Do you care to say anything about having the operations performed on you? She spoke only two sentences. No, sir, I have not. It is up to my people. Her people, whoever they were, did not rise to Buck's defense. The board approved Pretty's request to have Buck sterilized. But Pretty was concerned that his attempts to achieve eugenic sterilizations would still be challenged by state and federal courts. At Pretty's instigation, Buck's case was next presented to the Virginia court. If the courts affirmed the act, Pretty believed, he would have complete authority to continue his eugenic efforts at the colony and even extend them to other colonies. The case, Buck versus Pretty, was filed in the Circuit Court of Amherst County in October 1924. On November 17, 1925, Carrie Buck appeared for her trial at the courthouse in Lynchburg. She found that Pretty had arranged nearly a dozen witnesses. The first, a district nurse from Charlottesville, testified that Emma and Carrie were impulsive, irresponsible mentally, and feeble-minded. Asked to provide examples of Carrie's troublesome behavior, she said Carrie had been found writing notes to boys. Four other women then testified about Emma and Carrie, but Pretty's most important witness was yet to come. Unbeknownst to Carrie and Emma, Pretty had sent a social worker from the Red Cross to examine Carrie's 8-month-old child Vivian, who was living with foster parents. If Vivian could also be shown to be feeble-minded, Pretty reasoned, his case would be closed. With three generations, Emma, Carrie, and Vivian, affected by imbecility, it would be hard to argue against the heredity of their mental capacity. The testimony did not go quite as smoothly as Pretty had planned. The social worker, veering sharply off script, began by admitting biases in her judgment. "Perhaps my knowledge of the mother may prejudice me." "Have you any impression about the child?" the prosecutor asked. The social worker was hesitant again. "It is difficult to judge the probabilities of a child as young as that, but it seems to me not quite a normal baby." "You would not judge the child as a normal baby?" "There is a look about it that is not quite normal, but just what it is, I can't tell." For a while, it seemed as if the future of eugenic sterilizations in America depended on the foggy impressions of a nurse who had been handed a cranky baby without toys. The trial took 5 hours, including a break for lunch. The deliberation was brief, the decision clinical. The court affirmed Pretty's decision to sterilize Carrie Buck. "The act complies with the requirements of due process of law," the decision read. "It is not a penal statute. It cannot be said, as contended, that the act divides a natural class of persons into two." Buck's lawyers appealed the decision. The case climbed to the Virginia Supreme Court, where Pretty's request to sterilize Buck was affirmed again. In the early spring of 1927, the trial reached the U.S. Supreme Court. Pretty had died, but his successor, John Bell, the new superintendent of the colony, was the appointed defendant. Buck versus Bell was argued before the Supreme Court in the spring of 1927. Right from the onset, the case was clearly neither about Buck nor Bell. It was a charged time. The entire nation was frothing with anguish about its history and inheritance. The Roaring Twenties stood at the tail end of a historic surge of immigration to the United States. Between 1890 and 1924, nearly 10 million immigrants, Jewish, Italian, Irish, and Polish workers, streamed into New York, San Francisco, and Chicago, packing the streets and tenements and inundating the markets with foreign tongues, rituals, and foods. By 1927, new immigrants comprised more than 40% of the populations of New York and Chicago. And as much as class anxiety had driven the eugenic efforts of England in the 1890s, race anxiety drove the eugenic efforts of Americans in the 1920s. Galton may have despised the great unwashed masses, but they were indisputably great and unwashed English masses. In America, in contrast, the great unwashed masses were increasingly foreign, and their genes, like their accents, were identifiably alien. Eugenicists such as Pretty had long worried that the flooding of America by immigrants would precipitate race suicide. The right people were being overrun by the wrong people, they argued, and the right genes corrupted by the wrong ones. If genes were fundamentally indivisible, as Mendel had shown, then a genetic blight, once spread, could never be erased. "A cross between any race and a Jew is a Jew," Madison Grant wrote. The only way of cutting off the defective germplasm, as one eugenicist described it, was to excise the organ that produced germplasm, i.e. to perform compulsory sterilizations of genetic unfits, such as Carrie Buck. To protect the nation against the menace of race deterioration, radical social surgery would need to be deployed. "The eugenic ravens are croaking for reform in England," Bateson wrote with obvious distaste in 1926. The American ravens croaked even louder. Counterpoised against the myth of race suicide and race deterioration was the equal and opposite myth of racial and genetic purity. Among the most popular novels of the early 20s, devoured by millions of Americans, was Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan of the Apes, a bodice-ripping saga involving an English aristocrat who, orphaned as an infant and raised by apes in Africa, retains not just his parents' complexion, bearing, and physique, but their moral rectitude, Anglo-Saxon values, and even the instinctual use of proper dinnerware. Tarzan, his straight and perfect figure, muscled as the best of the ancient Roman gladiators must have been muscled, exemplified the ultimate victory of nature over nurture. If a white man raised by jungle apes could retain the integrity of a white man in a flannel suit, then surely racial purity could be maintained in any circumstance. Against this backdrop, the U.S. Supreme Court took scarcely any time to reach its decision on Buck versus Bell. On May 2, 1927, a few weeks before Carrie Buck's 21st birthday, the Supreme Court handed down its verdict. Writing the 8-1 majority opinion, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. reasoned, "It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime, or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes." Holmes, the son of a physician, a humanist, a scholar of history, a man widely celebrated for his skepticism of social dogmas, and soon to be one of the nation's most vocal advocates of judicial and political moderation, was evidently tired of the Bucks and their babies. "Three generations of imbeciles is enough," he wrote. Carrie Buck was sterilized by tubal ligation on October 19, 1927. That morning, around 9 o'clock, she was moved to the state colony's infirmary. At 10 o'clock, narcotized on morphine and atropine, she lay down on a gurney in a surgical room. A nurse administered anesthesia, and Buck drifted into sleep. Two doctors and two nurses were in attendance, an unusual turnout for such a routine procedure, but this was a special case. John Bell, the superintendent, opened her abdomen with an incision in the midline. He removed a section of both fallopian tubes, tied the ends of the tubes, and sutured them shut. The wounds were cauterized with carbolic acid and sterilized with alcohol. There were no surgical complications. The chain of heredity had been broken. The first case operated on under the sterilization law had gone just as planned, and the patient was discharged in excellent health, Bell wrote. Buck recovered in her room uneventfully. 6 decades and 2 years, no more than a passing glance of time, separate Mendel's initial experiments on peas and the court-mandated sterilization of Carrie Buck. Yet in this brief flash of 6 decades, the gene had transformed from an abstract concept in a botanical experiment to a powerful instrument of social control. As Buck versus Bell was being argued in the Supreme Court in 1927, the rhetoric of genetics and eugenics penetrated social, political, and personal discourses in the United States. In 1927, the state of Indiana passed a revised version of an earlier law to sterilize confirmed criminals, idiots, imbeciles, and rapists. Other states followed with even more draconian legal measures to sterilize and confine men and women judged to be genetically inferior. While state-sponsored sterilization programs expanded throughout the nation, a grassroots movement to personalize genetic selection was also gaining popularity. In the 1920s, millions of Americans thronged to agricultural fairs where, alongside toothbrushing demonstrations, popcorn machines, and hay rides, the public encountered Better Babies contests, in which children, often as young as 1 or 2 years old, were proudly displayed on tables and pedestals, like dogs or cattle, as physicians, psychiatrists, dentists and nurses in white coats, examined their eyes and teeth, prodded their skin, and measured heights, weights, skull sizes, and temperaments to select the healthiest and fittest variants. The fittest babies were then paraded through the fairs. Their pictures were featured prominently on posters, newspapers, and magazines, generating passive support for a national eugenics movement. Davenport, the Harvard-trained zoologist famous for establishing the Eugenics Record Office, created a standardized evaluation form to judge the fittest babies. Davenport instructed his judges to examine the parents before judging the children. You should score 50% for heredity before you begin to examine a baby. A prize winner at 2 may be an epileptic at 10. These fairs often contained Mendel booths, where the principles of genetics and the laws of inheritance were demonstrated using puppets. In 1927, a film called Are You Fit to Marry? By Harry Hazelton, another eugenics-obsessed doctor, played to packed audiences across the United States. The revival of an earlier film titled The Black Stork, the plot involved a physician, played by Hazelden himself, who refuses to perform life-saving operations on disabled infants in an effort to cleanse the nation of defective children. The film ends with a woman who has a nightmare of bearing a mentally defective child. She awakens and decides that she and her fiancé must get tested before their marriage to ensure their genetic compatibility. By the late 1920s, premarital genetic fitness tests with assessments of family histories of mental retardation, epilepsy, deafness, skeletal diseases, dwarfism, and blindness were being widely advertised to the American public. Ambitiously, Hazelden meant to market his film as a date night movie. It had love, romance, suspense, and humor, with some retail infanticide thrown in on the side. As the front of the American eugenics movement advanced from imprisonment to sterilization to outright murder, European eugenicists watched the escalation with a mix of eagerness and envy. By 1936, less than a decade after Buck versus Bell, a vastly more virulent form of genetic cleansing would engulf that continent like a violent contagion, morphing the language of genes and inheritance into its most potent and macabre form. Part 2. In the sum of the parts, there are only the parts. Deciphering the Mechanism of Inheritance, 1930 to 1970. Abed. I am the family face. Flesh perishes. I live on. Projecting trait and trace through time to times anon, and leaping from place to place over oblivion. Thomas Hardy, Heredity. The day before our visit with Moni, my father and I took a walk in Calcutta. We started near Salada Station, where my grandmother had stepped off the train from Barishal in 1946, with 5 boys and 4 steel trunks in tow. From the edge of the station, we retraced their path, walking along Prafulla Chandra Road, past the bustling wet market, with open-air stalls of fish and vegetables on the left and the stagnating pond of water hyacinths on the right, then turned left again, heading toward the city. The road narrowed sharply and the crowd thickened. On both sides of the street, the larger apartments divided into tenements, as if driven by some furious biological process, one room splitting into 2, 2 becoming 4, and 4, 8. The streets reticulated and the sky vanished. There was the clank of cooking and the mineral smell of coal smoke. At a pharmacist's shop, we turned into the inlet of Hyatt Khan Lane and walked toward the house that my father and his family had occupied. The rubbish heap was still there, breeding its multi-generational population of feral dogs. The front door of the house opened into a small courtyard. A woman was in the kitchen downstairs about to behead a coconut with a scythe. "Are you Biputi's daughter?" my father asked in Bengali, out of the blue. Bhupati Mukhopadhyay had owned the house and rented it to my grandmother. He was no longer alive, but my father recalled 2 children, a son and a daughter. The woman looked at my father warily. He had already stepped past the threshold and climbed onto the raised veranda, a few feet from the kitchen. "Does Bhupati's family still live here?" The questions were launched without any formal introduction. I noted a deliberate change in his accent. The softened hiss of the consonant in his words, the dental ch of West Bengali softening into the sibilant s of the East. In Calcutta, I knew every accent is a surgical probe. Bengalis send up their vowels and consonants like survey drones to test the identities of their listeners, to sniff out their sympathies, to confirm their allegiances. "No, I am his brother's daughter-in-law," the woman said. "We have lived here since Bibhuti's son died." It is difficult to describe what happened next, except to say that it is a moment that occurs uniquely in the histories of refugees. A tiny bolt of understanding passed between them. The woman recognized my father, not the actual man, whom she had never met, but the form of the man, a boy returning home. In Calcutta, in Berlin, Peshawar, Delhi, Dhaka, men like this seemed to turn up every day, appearing out of nowhere off the streets and walking unannounced into houses, stepping casually over thresholds into their past. Her manner warmed visibly. "Were you the family that lived here once? Weren't there many brothers?" She asked all this matter-of-factly, as if this visit had been long overdue. Her son, about 12 years old, peeked out from the window upstairs with a textbook in his hand. I knew that window. Jagu had parked himself there for days on end, staring into the courtyard. "It's all right," she said to her son, motioning with her hands. He fled inside. She turned to my father. "Go upstairs if you like, look around, but leave the shoes on the stairwell." I removed my sneakers, and the ground felt instantly intimate on my soles, as if I had always lived here. My father walked around the house with me. It was smaller than I had expected, as places reconstructed from borrowed memories inevitably are, but also duller and dustier. Memories sharpen the past. It is reality that decays. We climbed a narrow gullet of stairs to a small pair of rooms. The four younger brothers, Rajesh, Nakul, Jagu, and my father, had shared one of the rooms. The eldest boy, Ratan, Moni's father, and my grandmother had shared the adjacent room, but as Jagu's mind had involuted into madness, she had moved Ratan out with his brothers and taken Jagu in. Jagu would never again leave her room. We climbed up to the balcony on the roof. The sky dilated at last. Dusk was falling so quickly that it seemed you could almost sense the curvature of the earth arching away from the sun. My father looked out toward the lights of the station. The train whistled in the distance like a desolate bird. He knew I was writing about heredity. "Genes," he said, frowning. "Is there a Bengali word?" I asked. He searched his inner lexicon. There was no word, but perhaps he could find a substitute. "A bed," he offered. I had never heard him use the term. It means indivisible or impenetrable, but it is also used loosely to denote identity. I marveled at the choice. It was an echo chamber of a word. Mendel or Bateson might have relished its many resonances, indivisible, impenetrable, inseparable, identity. I asked my father what he thought about Moni, Rajesh, and Jagu. "Abider dosh," he said. "A flaw in identity, a genetic illness, a blemish that cannot be separated from the self." The same phrase served all meanings. He had made peace with its indivisibility. For all the talk in the late 1920s about the links between genes and identity, the gene itself appeared to possess little identity of its own. If a scientist had been asked what a gene was made of, how it accomplished its function, or where it resided within the cell, there would be few satisfactory answers. Even as genetics was being used to justify sweeping changes in law and society, the gene itself had remained a doggedly abstract entity, a ghost lurking in the biological machine. The black box of genetics was pried open almost accidentally by an unlikely scientist working on an unlikely organism. In 1907, when William Bateson visited the United States to give talks on Mendel's discovery, he stopped in New York to meet Thomas Hunt Morgan, the cell biologist. Bateson was not particularly impressed. "Morgan is a blockhead," he wrote to his wife. "He is in a continuous whirl, very active and inclined to be noisy." Noisy, active, obsessive, eccentric, with a dervish-like mind that spiraled from one scientific question to the next, Thomas Morgan was a professor of zoology at Columbia University. His main interest was embryology, At first, Morgan was not even interested in whether units of heredity existed or how or where they were stored. The principal question he cared about concerned development. How does an organism emerge from a single cell? Morgan had resisted Mendel's theory of heredity at first, arguing that it was unlikely that complex embryological information could be stored in discrete units in the cell, hence Bateson's blockhead comment. Eventually, however, Morgan had become convinced by Bateson's evidence. It was hard to argue against Mendel's bulldog, who came armed with charts of data. Yet, even as he had come to accept the existence of genes, Morgan had remained perplexed about their material form. Cell biologists look, geneticists count, biochemists clean, the scientist Arthur Kornberg once said. Indeed, armed with microscopes, cell biologists had become accustomed to a cellular world in which visible structures performed identifiable functions within cells. But thus far, the gene had been visible only in a statistical sense. Morgan wanted to uncover the physical basis of heredity. "We are interested in heredity not primarily as a mathematical formulation," he wrote, "but rather as a problem concerning the cell, the egg, and the sperm." But where might genes be found within cells? Intuitively, biologists had long guessed that the best place to visualize a gene was the embryo. In the 1890s, a German embryologist working with sea urchins in Naples, Theodor Boveri, had proposed that genes resided in chromosomes, thread-like filaments that stained blue with aniline, and lived, coiled like springs, in the nucleus of cells. The word chromosome was coined by Boveri's colleague, Wilhelm von Waldheyer-Hartz. Boveri's hypothesis was corroborated by work performed by two other scientists, Walter Sutton, a grasshopper-collecting farm boy from the prairies of Kansas, had grown into a grasshopper-collecting scientist in New York. In the summer of 1902, working on grasshopper sperm and egg cells, which have particularly gigantic chromosomes, Sutton also postulated that genes were physically carried on chromosomes. And Boveri's own student, a biologist named Nettie Stevens, had become interested in the determination of sex. In 1905, using cells from the common mealworm, Stevens demonstrated that maleness in worms was determined by a unique factor, the Y chromosome. That was only present in male embryos, but never in female ones. Under a microscope, the Y chromosome looks like any other chromosome, a squiggle of DNA that stains brightly blue, except that it is shorter and stubbier compared to the X chromosome. Having pinpointed the location of gender-carrying genes to a single chromosome, Stevens proposed that all genes might be carried on chromosomes. Thomas Morgan admired the work of Boveri, Sutton, and Stevens, but he still yearned for a more tangible description of the gene. Boveri had identified the chromosome as the physical residence for genes, but the deeper architecture of genes and chromosomes still remained unclear. How were genes organized on chromosomes? Were they strung along chromosomal filaments, like pearls on a string? Did every gene have a unique chromosomal address? Did genes overlap? Was one gene physically or chemically linked to another? Morgan approached these questions by studying yet another model organism, fruit flies. He began to breed flies sometime around 1905. Some of Morgan's colleagues would later claim that his first stock came from a flock of flies above a pile of overripe fruit in a grocery store in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Others suggested that he got his first flies from a colleague in New York. A year later, he was breeding maggots by the thousands in milk bottles filled with rotting fruit in a third-floor laboratory at Columbia University. Bunches of overripe bananas hung from sticks. The smell of fermented fruit was overpowering, and a haze of escaped flies lifted off the tables like a buzzing veil every time Morgan moved. The students called his laboratory the Fly Room. It was about the same size and shape as Mendel's garden, and in time, it would become an equally iconic site in the history of genetics. Like Mendel, Morgan began by identifying heritable traits, visible variants that he could track over generations. He had visited Hugo de Vries's garden in Amsterdam in the early 1900s and become particularly interested in de Vries's plant mutants. Did fruit flies have mutations as well? By scoring thousands of flies under the microscope, he began to catalog dozens of mutant flies. A rare white-eyed fly appeared spontaneously among the typically red-eyed flies. Other mutant flies had forked bristles, sable-colored bodies, curved legs, bent bat-like wings, disjointed abdomens, deformed eyes, a Halloween's parade of oddballs. A flock of students joined him in New York, each one odd in his own right, a tightly wound, precise Midwesterner named Alfred Sturtevant. Calvin Bridges, a brilliant, grandiose young man given to fantasies about free love and promiscuity, and paranoid, obsessive Herman Muller, who jostled daily for Morgan's attention. Morgan openly favored Bridges. It was Bridges, as an undergraduate student assigned to wash bottles, who had spotted among hundreds of vermilion-eyed flies the white-eyed mutant that would become the basis for many of Morgan's crucial experiments. Morgan admired Sturtevant for his discipline and his work ethic. Muller was favored the least. Morgan found him shifty, laconic, and disengaged from the other members of the lab. Eventually, all three students would quarrel fiercely, unleashing a cycle of envy and destructiveness that would blaze through the discipline of genetics. But for now, in a fragile peace dominated by the buzz of flies, they immersed themselves in experiments on genes and chromosomes. By breeding normal flies with mutants, mating white-eyed males with red-eyed females, say, Morgan and his students could track the inheritance of traits across multiple generations. The mutants, again, would prove crucial to these experiments. Only the outliers could illuminate the nature of normal heredity. To understand the significance of Morgan's discovery, we need to return to Mendel. In Mendel's experiments, every gene had behaved like an independent entity, a free agent. Flower color, for instance, had no link with seed texture or stem height. Each characteristic was inherited independently, and all combinations of traits were possible. The result of each cross was thus a perfect genetic roulette. If you crossed a tall plant with purple flowers with a short plant with white flowers, you would eventually produce all sorts of mixes, tall plants with white flowers and short plants with purple flowers and so forth. But Morgan's fruit fly genes did not always behave independently. Between 1905 and 1908, Morgan and his students crossed thousands of fruit fly mutants with each other to create tens of thousands of flies. The result of each cross was meticulously recorded: white-eyed, sable-colored, bristled, short-winged. When Morgan examined these crosses, tabulated across dozens of notebooks, he found a surprising pattern. Some genes acted as if they were linked to each other. The gene responsible for creating white eyes, called white-eyed, for instance, was inescapably linked to maleness. No matter how Morgan crossed his flies, only males were born with white eyes. Similarly, the gene for sable color was linked with the gene that specified the shape of a wing. For Morgan, this genetic linkage could only mean one thing. Genes had to be physically linked to each other. In flies, the gene for sable color was never, or rarely, inherited independently from the gene for miniature wings, because they were both carried on the same chromosome. If two beads are on the same string, then they are always tied together, no matter how one attempts to mix and match strings. For two genes on the same chromosome, the same principle applied. There was no simple way to separate the forked bristle gene from the coat color gene. The inseparability of features had a material basis. The chromosome was a string along which certain genes were permanently strung. Morgan had discovered an important modification to Mendel's laws. Genes did not travel separately. Instead, they moved in packs. Packets of information were themselves packaged into chromosomes and ultimately in cells, but the discovery had a more important consequence. Conceptually, Morgan had not just linked genes, he had linked two disciplines, cell biology and genetics. The gene was not a purely theoretical unit. It was a material thing that lived in a particular location and a particular form within a cell. Now that we locate them, genes, on chromosomes, Morgan reasoned, are we justified in regarding them as material units, as chemical bodies of a higher order than molecules? The establishment of linkage between genes prompted a second and third discovery. Let us return to linkage. Morgan's experiments had established that genes that were physically linked to each other on the same chromosome were inherited together. If the gene that produces blue eyes, call it B, is linked to a gene that produces blonde hair, BL, then children with blonde hair will inevitably tend to inherit blue eyes. The example is hypothetical, but the principle that it illustrates is true. But there was an exception to linkage. Occasionally, very occasionally, a gene could unlink itself from its partner genes and swap places from the paternal chromosome to the maternal chromosome, resulting in a fleetingly rare blue-eyed, dark-haired child, or, conversely, a dark-eyed, blonde-haired child. Morgan called this phenomenon crossing over. In time, as we shall see, the crossing over of genes would launch a revolution in biology, establishing the principle that genetic information could be mixed, matched, and swapped, not just between sister chromosomes, but between organisms and across species. The final discovery prompted by Morgan's work was also the result of a methodical study of crossing over. Some genes were so tightly linked that they never crossed over. These genes, Morgan's students hypothesized, were physically closest to each other on the chromosome. Other genes, although linked, were more prone to splitting apart. These genes had to be positioned farther apart on the chromosome. Genes that had no linkage whatsoever had to be present on entirely different chromosomes. The tightness of genetic linkage, in short, was a surrogate for the physical proximity of genes on chromosomes. By measuring how often two features, blonde-hairedness and blue-eyedness, were linked or unlinked, you could measure the distance between their genes on the chromosome. On a winter evening in 1911, Sturtevant, then a 20-year-old undergraduate student in Morgan's lab, brought the available experimental data on the linkage of Drosophila, fruit fly, genes, to his room, and neglecting his mathematics homework, spent the night constructing the first map of genes in flies. If A was tightly linked to B and very loosely linked to C, Sturtevant reasoned, then the three genes must be positioned on the chromosome in that order and with proportional distance from each other. If an allele that created notched wings, N, tend to be co-inherited with an allele that made short bristles, SB, then the two genes, N and SB, must be on the same chromosome, while the unlinked gene for eye color must be on a different chromosome. By the end of the evening, Sturtevant had sketched the first linear genetic map of half a dozen genes along a Drosophila chromosome. Sturtevant's rudimentary genetic map would foreshadow the vast and elaborate efforts to map genes along the human genome in the 1990s. By using linkage to establish the relative positions of genes on chromosomes, Sturtevant would also lay the groundwork for the future cloning of genes tied to complex familial diseases, such as breast cancer, schizophrenia, and Alzheimer's disease. In about 12 hours, in an undergraduate dorm room in New York, he had poured the foundation for the Human Genome Project. Between 1905 and 1925, the fly room at Columbia was the epicenter of genetics, a catalytic chamber for the new science. Ideas ricocheted off ideas like atoms splitting atoms. The chain reaction of discoveries, linkage, crossing over, the linearity of genetic maps, the distance between genes, burst forth with such ferocity that it seemed at times that genetics was not born but zippered into existence. Over the next decades, a spray of Nobel Prizes would be showered on the occupants of the room. Morgan, his students' students, and even their students would all win the prize for their discoveries. But beyond linkage and gene maps, even Morgan had a difficult time imagining or describing genes in a material form. What chemical could possibly carry information in threads and maps? It is a testament to the ability of scientists to accept abstractions as truths that 50 years after the publication of Mendel's paper, from 1865 to 1915, biologists knew genes only through the properties they produced. Genes specified traits. Genes could become mutated and thereby specify alternative traits. And genes tended to be chemically or physically linked to each other. Dimly, as if through a veil, geneticists were beginning to visualize patterns and themes, threads, strings, maps, crossings, broken and unbroken lines, chromosomes that carried information in a coded and compressed form. But no one had seen a gene in action or knew its material essence. The central quest of the study of heredity seemed like an object perceived only through its shadows, tantalizingly invisible to science. If urchins, mealworms, and fruit flies seemed far removed from the world of humans, if the concrete relevance of Morgan's or Mendel's findings was ever in doubt, then the events of the violent spring of 1917 proved otherwise. In March that year, as Morgan was writing his papers on genetic linkage in his fly room in New York, a volley of brutal popular uprisings ricocheted through Russia, ultimately decapitating the Tsarist monarchy and culminating in the creation of the Bolshevik government. At face value, the Russian Revolution had little to do with genes. The Great War had whipped a starving, weary population into a murderous frenzy of discontent. The Tsar was considered weak and ineffectual. The army was mutinous. The factory workers galled. Inflation ran amok. By March 1917, Tsar Nicholas II had been forced to abdicate the throne. But genes and linkage were certainly potent forces in this history. The Tsarina of Russia, Alexandra, was the granddaughter of Queen Victoria of England, and she carried the marks of that heritage. Not just the carved obelisk of the nose, or the fragile enamel-like sheen of her skin, but also a gene that caused hemophilia B, a lethal bleeding disorder that had crisscrossed through Victoria's descendants. Hemophilia is caused by a single mutation that disables a protein in the clotting of blood. In the absence of this protein, blood refuses to clot, and even a small nick or wound can accelerate into a lethal bleeding crisis. The name of the illness, from Greek haimo, blood, and philia, to like or love, is actually a wry comment on its tragedy. Hemophiliacs like to bleed all too easily. Hemophilia, like white eyes and fruit flies, is a sex-linked genetic illness. Females can be carriers and transmit the gene, but only males are afflicted by the disease. The mutation in the hemophilia gene, which affects the clotting of blood, had likely arisen spontaneously in Queen Victoria at birth. Her eighth child, Leopold, had inherited the gene and died of a brain hemorrhage at age 30. The gene had also been passed from Victoria to her second daughter, Alice, and then from Alice to her daughter, Alexandra, the Tsarina of Russia. In the summer of 1904, Alexandra, still an unsuspecting carrier of the gene, gave birth to Alexei, the Tsarevich of Russia. Little is known about the medical history of his childhood, but his attendants must have noticed something amiss, that the young prince bruised all too easily, or that his nosebleeds were often unstoppable. While the precise nature of his ailment was kept secret, Alexei continued to be a pale, sickly boy. He bled frequently and spontaneously. A playful fall or a nick in his skin, even a bumpy horse ride, could precipitate disaster. As Alexei grew older and the hemorrhages more life-threatening, Alexandra began to rely on a Russian monk of legendary unctuousness, Grigory Rasputin, who promised to heal the Tsar-to-be. While Rasputin claimed that he kept Alexei alive using various herbs, salves, and strategically offered prayers, most Russians considered him an opportunistic fraud. He was rumored to be having an affair with the Tsarina. His continuous presence in the royal family and his growing influence on Alexandra were considered evidence of a crumbling monarchy gone utterly batty. The economic, political, and social forces that unloosed themselves on the streets of Petrograd and launched the Russian Revolution were vastly more complex than Alexei's hemophilia or Rasputin's machinations. History cannot devolve into medical biography, but nor can it stand outside it. The Russian Revolution may not have been about genes, but it was very much about heredity. The disjunction between the prince's all-too-human genetic inheritance and his all-too-exalted political inheritance must have seemed particularly evident to the critics of the monarchy. The metaphorical potency of Alexei's illness was also undeniable, symptomatic of an empire gone sick, dependent on bandages and prayers, hemorrhaging at its core. The French had tired of a greedy queen who ate cake. The Russians were fed up with a sickly prince swallowing strange herbs to combat a mysterious illness. Rasputin was poisoned, shot, slashed, bludgeoned, and drowned to death by his rivals on December 30, 1916. Even by the grim standards of Russian assassinations, the violence of this murder was a testimony to the visceral hatred that he had inspired in his enemies. In the early summer of 1918, the royal family was moved to Yekaterinburg and placed under house arrest. On the evening of July 17, 1918, a month shy of Alexei's 14th birthday, a firing squad instigated by the Bolsheviks burst into the Tsar's house and assassinated the whole family. Alexei was shot twice in the head. The bodies of the children were supposedly scattered and buried nearby, but Alexei's body was not found. In 2007, an archaeologist exhumed two partially burned skeletons from a bonfire site near the house where Alexei had been murdered. One of the skeletons belonged to a 13-year-old boy. Genetic testing of the bones confirmed that the body was Alexei's. Had the full genetic sequence of the skeleton been analyzed, the investigators might have found the culprit gene for hemophilia B, the mutation that had crossed one continent and four generations and insinuated itself into a defining political moment of the 20th century. Truths and Reconciliations. All changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. William Butler Yeats, Easter, 1916. The gene was born outside biology. By this, I mean the following. If you consider the major questions raging through the biological sciences in the late 19th century, heredity does not rank particularly high on that list. Scientists studying living organisms were far more preoccupied with other matters. Embryology, cell biology, the origin of species, and evolution. How do cells function? How does an organism arise from an embryo? How do species originate? What generates the diversity of the natural world? Yet attempts to answer these questions had all become mired at precisely the same juncture. The missing link, in all cases, was information. Every cell and every organism needs information to carry out its physiological function. But where does that information come from? An embryo needs a message to become an adult organism, but what carries this message? Or how, for that matter, does one member of a species know that it is a member of that species and not another? The ingenious property of the gene was that it offered a potential solution to all these problems in a single sweep. Information for a cell to carry out a metabolic function? It came from a cell's genes, of course. The message encrypted in an embryo? Again, it was all encoded in genes. When an organism reproduces, it transmits the instructions to build embryos, make cells function, enable metabolism, perform ritual mating dances, give wedding speeches, and produce future organisms of the same species, all in one grand unified gesture. Heredity cannot be a peripheral question in biology. It must rank among its central questions. When we think of heredity in a colloquial sense, we think about the inheritance of unique or particular features across generations. A peculiar shape of a father's nose or the susceptibility to an unusual illness that runs through a family. But the real conundrum that heredity solves is much more general. What is the nature of instruction that allows an organism to build a nose, any nose, in the first place? The delayed recognition of the gene as the answer to the central problem of biology had a strange consequence. Genetics had to be reconciled with other major fields of biology as an afterthought. If the gene was the central currency of biological information, then major characteristics of the living world, not just heredity, should be explicable in terms of genes. First, genes had to explain the phenomenon of variation. How could discrete units of heredity explain that human eyes, say, do not have six discrete forms but seemingly 6 billion continuous variants? Second, genes had to explain evolution. How could the inheritance of such units explain that organisms have acquired vastly different forms and features over time? And third, genes had to explain development. How could individual units of instruction prescribe the code to create a mature organism out of an embryo? We might describe these three reconciliations as attempts to explain nature's past, present, and future through the lens of the gene. Evolution describes nature's past. How did living things arise? Variation describes its present. Why do they look like this now? And embryogenesis attempts to capture the future. How does a single cell create a living thing that will eventually acquire its particular form? In two transformative decades between 1920 and 1940, the first two of these questions, i.e. variation and evolution, would be solved by unique alliances between geneticists, anatomists, cell biologists, statisticians, and mathematicians. The third question, embryological development, would require a much more concerted effort to solve. Ironically, even though embryology had launched the discipline of modern genetics, the reconciliation between genes and genesis would be a vastly more engaging scientific problem. In 1909, a young mathematician named Ronald Fisher entered Caius College in Cambridge. Born with a hereditary condition that caused a progressive loss of vision, Fisher had become nearly blind by his early teens. He had learned mathematics largely without paper or pen, and thus acquired the ability to visualize problems in his mind's eye before writing equations on paper. Fisher excelled at math as a secondary school student, but his poor eyesight became a liability at Cambridge. Humiliated by his tutors, who were disappointed in his abilities to read and write mathematics, he switched to medicine, but failed his exams, like Darwin, like Mendel, and like Galton. The failure to achieve conventional milestones of success seems to be a running theme in this story. In 1914, as war broke out in Europe, he began working as a statistical analyst in the city of London. By day, Fisher examined statistical information for insurance companies. By night, with the world almost fully extinguished to his vision, he turned to theoretical aspects of biology. The scientific problem that engrossed Fisher also involved reconciling biology's mind with its eye. By 1910, the greatest minds in biology had accepted that discrete particles of information carried on chromosomes were the carriers of hereditary information. But everything visible about the biological world suggested near-perfect continuity. 19th-century biometricians such as Quetelet and Galton had demonstrated that human traits such as height, weight, and even intelligence were distributed in smooth, continuous bell-shaped curves. Even the development of an organism, the most obviously inherited chain of information, seemed to progress through smooth, continuous stages and not in discrete bursts. A caterpillar does not become a butterfly in stuttering steps. If you plot the beak sizes of finches, the points fit on a continuous curve. How could particles of information, pixels of heredity, give rise to the observed smoothness of the living world? Fisher realized that the careful mathematical modeling of hereditary traits might resolve this rift. Mendel had discovered the discontinuous nature of genes, Fisher knew, because he had chosen highly discrete traits and crossed pure breeding plants to begin with. But what if real-world traits, such as height or skin color, were the result of not a single gene with just two states, tall and short, on and off, but of multiple genes? What if there were five genes that governed height, say, or seven genes that controlled the shape of a nose? The mathematics to model a trait controlled by five or seven genes, Fisher discovered, was not all that complex. With just three genes in question, there would be six alleles or gene variants in total, three from the mother and three from the father. Simple combinatorial mathematics yielded 27 unique combinations of these six gene variants. And if each combination generated a unique effect on height, Fisher found, the result smoothened out. If he started with five genes, the permutations were even greater in number, and the variations in height produced by these permutations seemed almost continuous. Add the effects of the environment, the impact of nutrition on height or sunlight exposure on skin color, and Fisher could imagine even more unique combinations and effects, ultimately generating perfectly smooth curves. Consider seven pieces of transparent paper colored with the seven basic colors of the rainbow. By juxtaposing the pieces of paper against each other and overlapping one color with another, one can almost produce every shade of color. The information in the sheets of paper remains discrete. The colors do not actually blend with each other, but the result of their overlap creates a spectrum of colors that seems virtually continuous. In 1918, Fisher published his analysis in a paper entitled "The Correlation Between Relatives on the Supposition of Mendelian Inheritance." The title was rambling, but the message was succinct. If you mix the effects of 3 to 5 variant genes on any trait, you could generate nearly perfect continuity in phenotype. The exact amount of human variability, he wrote, could be explained by rather obvious extensions of Mendelian genetics. The individual effect of a gene, Fisher argued, was like a dot of a pointillist painting. If you zoomed in close enough, you might see the dots as individual, discrete. But what we observed and experienced in the natural world from afar was an aggregation of dots, pixels merging to form a seamless picture. The second reconciliation between genetics and evolution required more than mathematical modeling. It hinged on experimental data. Darwin had reasoned that evolution works via natural selection, but for natural selection to work, there had to be something natural to select. A population of organisms in the wild must have enough natural variation such that winners and losers can be picked. A flock of finches on an island, for instance, needs to possess enough intrinsic diversity in beak sizes such that a season of drought might be able to select birds with the toughest or longest beaks. Take that diversity away, force all finches to have the same beak, and selection comes up empty-handed. All the birds go extinct in a fell swoop. Evolution grinds to a halt. But what is the engine that generates natural variation in the wild? Hugo de Vries had proposed that mutations were responsible for variation. Changes in genes created changes in forms that could be selected by natural forces. But de Vries's conjecture predated the molecular definition of the gene. Was there experimental proof that identifiable mutations in real genes were responsible for variation? Were mutations sudden and spontaneous, or were abundant natural genetic variations already present in wild populations? And what happened to genes upon natural selection? In the 1930s, Theodosius Dobzhansky, a Ukrainian biologist who had emigrated to the United States, set out to describe the extent of genetic variation in wild populations. Dobzhansky had trained with Thomas Morgan in the fly room at Columbia. But to describe genes in the wild, he knew that he would have to go wild himself. Armed with nets, fly cages, and rotting fruit, he began to collect wild flies, first near the laboratory at Caltech, then on Mount San Jacinto along the Sierra Nevada in California, and then in forests and mountains all over the United States. His colleagues, confined to their lab benches, thought that he had gone fully mad. He might as well have left for the Galapagos. The decision to hunt for variation in wild flies proved critical. In a wild fly species named Drosophila pseudoobscura, for instance, Dobzhansky found multiple gene variants that influenced complex traits, such as lifespan, eye structure, bristle morphology, and wing size. The most striking examples of variation involve flies collected from the same region that possess two radically different configurations of the same genes. Dobzhansky called these genetic variants races. Using Morgan's technique of mapping genes by virtue of their placement along a chromosome, Dobzhansky made a map of three genes, A, B, and C. In some flies, the three genes were strung along the fifth chromosome in one configuration, A, B, C. In other flies, Dobzhansky found that configuration had been fully inverted to C, B, A. The distinction between the two races of flies by virtue of a single chromosomal inversion was the most dramatic example of genetic variation that any geneticist had ever seen in a natural population. But there was more. In September 1943, Dobzhansky launched an attempt to demonstrate variation, selection, and evolution in a single experiment, to recreate the Galapagos in a carton. He inoculated two sealed aerated cartons with a mixture of two fly strains, ABC and CBA, in a 1-to-1 ratio. One carton was exposed to a cold temperature. The other, inoculated with the same mixture of strains, was left at room temperature. The flies were fed, cleaned, and watered in that enclosed space for generation upon generation. The populations grew and fell. New larvae were born, matured into flies, and died in that carton. Lineages and families, kingdoms of flies, were established and extinguished. When Dobzhansky harvested the two cages after 4 months, he found that the populations had changed dramatically. In the cold carton, the ABC strain had nearly doubled, while the CBA had dwindled. In the carton kept at room temperature, the two strains had acquired the opposite ratio. He had captured all the critical ingredients of evolution. Starting with a population with natural variation in gene configurations, he had added a force of natural selection, temperature. The fittest organisms, those best adapted to low or high temperatures, had survived. As new flies had been born, selected, and bred, the gene frequencies had changed, resulting in populations with new genetic compositions. To explain the intersection of genetics, natural selection, and evolution in formal terms, Dobzhensky resurrected two important words, genotype and phenotype. A genotype is an organism's genetic composition. It can refer to one gene, the configuration of genes, or even an entire genome. A phenotype, in contrast, refers to an organism's physical or biological attributes and characteristics, the color of an eye, the shape of a wing, or resistance to hot or cold temperatures. Dobzhensky could now restate the essential truth of Mendel's discovery, a gene determines a physical feature, by generalizing that idea across multiple genes and multiple features. A genotype determines a phenotype. But two important modifications to this rule were necessary to complete the scheme. First, Dobzhensky noted, genotypes were not the sole determinants of phenotypes. Obviously, the environment or the milieu that surrounds an organism contributes to its physical attributes. The shape of a boxer's nose is not just the consequence of his genetic heritage. It is determined by the nature of his chosen profession and the number of physical assaults on its cartilage. If Dobzhensky had capriciously trimmed the wings off all the flies in one box, he would have affected their phenotypes, the shape of their wings, without ever touching their genes. In other words, genotype plus environment equals phenotype. And second, some genes are activated by external triggers or by random chance. In flies, for instance, a gene that determines the size of a vestigial wing depends on temperature. You cannot predict the shape of the wing based on the fly's genes or on the environment alone. You need to combine the two pieces of information. For such genes, neither the genotype nor the environment is the sole predictor of outcome. It is the intersection of genes, environment, and chance. In humans, a mutant BRCA1 gene increases the risk for breast cancer. But not all women carrying the BRCA1 mutation develop cancer. Such trigger-dependent or chance-dependent genes are described as having partial or incomplete penetrance, i.e., even if the gene is inherited, its capacity to penetrate into an actual attribute is not absolute, or a gene may have variable expressivity, i.e., even if the gene is inherited, its capacity to become expressed as an actual attribute varies from one individual to another. One woman with the BRCA1 mutation might develop an aggressive metastatic variant of breast cancer at age 30. Another woman with the same mutation might develop an indolent variant, and yet another might not develop breast cancer at all. We still do not know what causes the difference of outcomes between these three women, but it is some combination of age, exposures, other genes, and bad luck. You cannot use just the genotype BRCA1 mutation to predict the final outcome with certainty. So the final modification might read as genotype plus environment plus triggers plus chance equal phenotype. Succinct, yet magisterial, this formula captured the essence of the interactions between heredity, chance, environment, variation, and evolution in determining the form and fate of an organism. In the natural world, variations in genotype exist in wild populations. These variations intersect with different environments, triggers, and chance to determine the attributes of an organism, a fly with greater or lesser resistance to temperature. When a severe selection pressure is applied, a rise in temperature or a sharp restriction of nutrients, organisms with the fittest phenotype are selected. The selective survival of such a fly results in its ability to produce more larvae, which inherit part of the genotype of the parent fly, resulting in a fly that is more adapted to that selective pressure. The process of selection, notably, acts on a physical or biological attribute, and the underlying genes are selected passively as a result. A misshapen nose might be the result of a particularly bad day in the ring, i.e. it may have nothing to do with genes, but if a mating contest is judged only by the symmetry of noses, then the bearer of the wrong kind of nose will be eliminated, even if that bearer possesses multiple other genes that are salubrious in the long run, a gene for tenacity or for withstanding excruciating pain. The entire gamut of these genes will be damned to extinction during the mating contest, all because of that damned nose. Phenotype, in short, drags genotypes behind it, like a cart pulling a horse, It is the perennial conundrum of natural selection that it seeks one thing, fitness, and accidentally finds another, genes that produce fitness. Genes that produce fitness become gradually overrepresented in populations through the selection of phenotypes, thereby allowing organisms to become more and more adapted to their environments. There is no such thing as perfection, only the relentless, thirsty matching of an organism to its environment. That is the engine that drives evolution. Dobzhensky's final flourish was to solve the mystery of mysteries that had preoccupied Darwin, the origin of species. The Galapagos in a carton experiment had demonstrated how a population of interbreeding organisms, flies, say, evolves over time. But if wild populations with variations in genotype keep interbreeding, Dobzhensky knew, a new species would never be formed. A species, after all, is fundamentally defined by its inability to interbreed with another. For a new species to arise, then, some factor must arise that makes interbreeding impossible. Dobzhensky wondered if the missing factor was geographic isolation. Imagine a population of organisms with gene variants that are capable of interbreeding. The population is suddenly split into two by some sort of geographical rift. A flock of birds from one island is storm-blown to a distant island and cannot fly back to its island of origin. The two populations now evolve independently, a la Darwin, until particular gene variants are selected in the two sites that become biologically incompatible. Even if the new birds can return to their original island, on ships, say, they cannot breed with their long-lost cousins of cousins. The offspring produced by the two birds possess genetic incompatibilities, garbled messages that do not allow them to survive or be fertile. Geographic isolation leads to genetic isolation and to eventual reproductive isolation. This mechanism of speciation was not just conjecture. Dobzhensky could demonstrate it experimentally. He mixed two flies from distant parts of the world into the same cage. The flies mated, gave rise to progeny, but the larvae grew into infertile adults. Using linkage analysis, geneticists could even trace an actual configuration of genes that evolved to make the progeny infertile. This was the missing link in Darwin's logic. Reproductive incompatibility, ultimately derived from genetic incompatibility, drove the origin of novel species. By the late 1930s, Dobzhensky began to realize that his understanding of genes, variation, and natural selection had ramifications far beyond biology. The bloody revolution of 1917, that had swept through Russia, attempted to erase all individual distinctions to prioritize a collective good. In contrast, a monstrous form of racism that was rising in Europe exaggerated and demonized individual distinctions. In both cases, Dobzhensky noted, the fundamental questions at stake were biological. What defines an individual? How does variation contribute to individuality? What is good for a species? In the 1940s, Dobzhensky would attack these questions directly. He would eventually become one of the most strident scientific critics of Nazi eugenics, Soviet collectivization, and European racism. But his studies on wild populations, variation, and natural selection had already provided crucial insights to these questions. First, it was evident that genetic variation was the norm, not the exception, in nature. American and European eugenicists insisted on artificial selection to promote human good, but in nature there was no single good. Different populations had widely divergent genotypes, and these diverse genetic types coexisted and even overlapped in the wild. Nature was not as hungry to homogenize genetic variation as human eugenicists had presumed. Indeed, Dobzhensky recognized that natural variation was a vital reservoir for an organism, an asset that far outweighed its liabilities. Without this variation, without deep genetic diversity, an organism might ultimately lose its capacity to evolve. Second, a mutation is just a variation by another name. In wild fly populations, Dobzhensky noted, no genotype was inherently superior. Whether the ABC or CBA strain survived depended on the environment and on gene-environment interactions. One